Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We've been having ongoing conversations about a slowly unfolding natural disaster with wide-ranging consequences in the Central Valley. Record snowpack in the southern Sierra Nevada is melting, and that is creating flooding across the Tulare Basin that hasn't been seen in years, possibly decades. It's already happening, and it will continue to intensify over the weeks and months. The area roughly spans from Fresno to Bakersfield, which is the state's agricultural mecca, and an area that is also home to many low-income communities with long-standing barriers. Nicole Foy is a California Divide CalMatters reporter based in the southern San Joaquin Valley and joins us with a firsthand look. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning.
So, Nicole, you're not only a journalist focused on this part of the Central Valley, you also call Bakersfield home. You have lived there since you were a child. So with that perspective, you know, and having experienced other high water events in the area, what is the big picture since you've been reporting on this since it started?
I mean, I think the most important thing to take away is that we haven't seen water like this in this part of the valley for some time. And it's very strange, like personally, and I think talking to other folks who are from this area, to go by and see a very, very full Kern River, to go by and be dry around almost anywhere you go in some of the southern parts of the valley and see every single canal and creek full to the brim, canals or creeks that I didn't even know really existed anymore. That's something that is very unusual here, I think, to residents, simply because the drought has been pretty bad in the past years, especially in the Central Valley. And so despite the fact that there is a history of, you know, especially kind of, you know, every decade or so of at least high water events and certainly past floods, I don't really think a lot of people were really prepared for what it would mean, especially in March when we really started to see the impact of just endless weeks of rain.
Right. And there already has been damage from winter storms. And then this flooding is just going to continue into the drier, warmer months. We're talking about an area where there are several counties in the state. And, you know, you don't have that near hindsight of having, you know, high water years because we've been going through drought as a state. So how has awareness about this slow moving disaster, how has it varied from one community to the next?
Yeah, I think the awareness of what's been going around on in sometimes even in folks' own counties, and also what could be coming as a lot of state officials and local officials are trying to prepare residents for more possible flooding as snow begins to melt. It really depends on where you are in this region. And honestly, if you've already been affected before, it's very common to find people, especially in maybe some of the urban centers who, you know, they know there's a canal like right outside of their neighborhood, but they've never really thought about the fact of like, what would happen if this canal is going to overflow into my neighborhood? And that's something that, depending on where you live and depending on what you're local officials may be coming to you and talking about, you may have to prepare for. Folks are wondering if they have flood insurance, you know, checking to see if they have flood insurance in areas that maybe they never, when they bought this house, they never thought about that. But if you have already experienced flooding, especially in some of these smaller towns and area in like Tulare County in particular, I'm thinking of, who have already experienced flooding, especially in the beginning of March when it was really bad, you are well aware of the risk now in a way that maybe you weren't, because a canal, a ditch, a river that you didn't really spend much time about suddenly came and swept away, you know, belongings, or just really caused damage in your area.
Hmm. Are there specific industries and areas that are particularly affected by this flooding or bracing themselves as the snow melts?
Yeah, I think there's kind of the ones that you would expect, especially given how much they were already struggling with weeks and months of rain. Farming and the dairy industry have been having a hard time. There's just been so much flooding that has either curtailed work that is supposed to be done at this time, or in the case of some dairies closer to the historic Tulare Lake, who suddenly had to move evacuate their entire operations in the middle of the night. And we're talking about moving thousands of cows through very difficult situations, putting workers and their own families at risk because water that they weren't expecting to come through their homes and their property just did. I think there's that's definitely some industries, agriculture in particular, is having a hard time with the flooding.
Yeah,
in the Central Valley.
Right. I mean, of course, there is a risk to public safety, but we're also talking about people's livelihoods as well. And there's been some videos that have gone viral since this first started happening back in March. The one that I think of is there was a ruptured levee and someone drove a truck into that ruptured part of a levee to fill it. And I think that just kind of hits home, like the drastic measures people are taking. Are you seeing this firsthand or talking about this with people who live in this part of the Central Valley?
Yeah, I really got to hear what it was like specifically for a group of dairy owners and workers along the Tule River in Tulare County. The flooding really started there in mid-March in a way that they were not prepared for. They suddenly had to wake up in the middle of the night, despite knowing that there was an evacuation order for area closer to the dam. They weren't really expecting it to come through and affect them because they have levees. They have there's measures in place, but it was a pretty dramatic time. A lot of people thought that they some of the dairy owners that I spoke to thought that they were going to really lose everything. Certainly there's a number of workers concerned about the future of their jobs. The dairy industry, dairy industry representatives in the Valley have told me that if flooding continues if they have similar events to what happened in March, which really necessitated the rapid evacuation and lots of damage to dairy farms in the area, they're anticipating they might have a $20 billion loss in their network just because of long-term impacts to supply chain issues, what happens when there's not enough that these days are not operating at full scale because they have to evacuate, or because when this was explained to me, and it was one of those things that I didn't think about, but that's not really a calm experience for many of the animals either. They're not just going to go back. If the production at some of these dairies is not just going to go back to normal immediately when everybody, including, the cows on the ranch themselves, go through a pretty traumatic experience. It has long-term effects, and of course has significant long-term effects on the local economy and California's ag industry. Dairy is the number one producer in the ag industry in California.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, I think about how California has an overwhelming Democratic majority politically, but the area is home to a lot of conservative areas. I mean, you have House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, right? He represents that part of the Central Valley. How does this dynamic of being a conservative area in a liberal state impact what we're seeing now?
Yeah, I don't know how much it's necessarily playing out in how it impacts policy or response. Like most of these areas, even very traditionally very conservative counties have received aid from the state, from the federal government. But there is, from what I've observed and heard from people, there is sometimes a frustration of wondering if they're not necessarily getting as much attention as they would if other parts of the state flooded. I know that there was a lot of concern. And not everybody necessarily tied it to ideological or political differences, but there was a lot of confusion about why it took so long for the state to request a major disaster declaration for this part of the county. And also, one of the ways that I think that it really plays into is that this is an area of the state that cares a lot about local control, especially when it comes to property and water rights and how that comes into local control and whether they want the state agencies coming in and telling them how to manage this disaster on their property. That is where things, I think, have gotten a little bit tricky, and it will be interesting to see how it continues continues to play out for the rest of the year.
Well, last week, the governor did visit the area. What was the big takeaway from the governor's visit?
I think one of the things that struck me the most was the general acceptance that there's going to continue to be significant flooding and damage in this area. I don't think I necessarily would have expected that. I think one of the things that the governor said, what, you know, as he was standing in the Corcoran area on a ranch that was already pretty damaged and not able to operate at normal capacity, said that, you know, where we're standing right now is going to be underwater probably in the next few weeks or months, depending on how the snow melt plays out. And, you know, there was a lot of promises of aid, assurances that the state has been working on these issues with local authorities for a while, that there are efforts being made to assist folks who are affected. But I don't know how much people who have already lost homes and are worried about losing more necessarily feel like from my reporting, that the state is doing everything that they can.
Hmm. Is there any good news or silver lining to all of this?
I think one of the silver linings that I took away from, especially when speaking with state emergency officials, was that although I think a number of residents, agencies, folks who are in charge of preventing some of the significant damage were pretty caught off guard, I think, by some of the significant flooding that we saw in mid-March when, like you said, when there, you know, folks were, you know, driving their cars into trying to stop water from flooding into their land. That was such a huge wake-up call that, and there is now the preparation for the coming snow melt. There's been actually a lot of time for state officials to prepare. I think that was a big wake-up call for officials. And from what I've heard, they've been frantically trying to take this time to shore up defenses where they can, whether that means raising levees or stuff like that, but also to try to get the word out to people, especially people in areas who may never have considered that they may be in a flood risk area, that they need to have an evacuation plan. They need to be paying attention to their local governments and anyone. So it doesn't just come down to a midnight visit from local law enforcement telling you that you have 10 minutes to get out of your house before it floods.
Finally, Nicole, you know, when this is something you're going to be following in the coming weeks and months, and even potentially even longer than that, because the last time this happened, it took, you know, nearly 2 years to recover. I mean, the cost of this is billions of dollars. When you're following this, you know, what are you going to be looking at when it comes to pockets of these communities that may be more vulnerable to the drastic consequences of the ongoing flooding of this region?
Yeah, I mean, I'm particularly interested in exactly that, in finding out which communities in particular are given the resources to not just recover from this, but to attempt to survive this. You know, there's so much water, there's so much snow that is expected to come down through these waterways eventually. I don't know if we really have a clear picture of where the next, you know, canal is going to overtop, where there's going to be the next flooding risk. But it can be very easy in a way to make sure that you can track what is being done to assist those communities. And in particular, I'm thinking about folks who may not have the resources that they need to repair their homes, to go back to work. I mean, farm workers in the valley have already been hit by losing so many days, weeks of work because of the rains. And many of them live in communities that are most at risk because of lack of infrastructure, because they're in unincorporated areas. And there's not always a lot of resources available. I know the state is trying, but I think that's really going to be the thing that I'll be looking for is what is the state going to do to assist some of these communities as they try to make it through this year and then recover?
And you also found that, you know, not all counties get the same assistance, whether it's state or federal, right?
Yeah. I mean, one significant thing that stands out is that Kings County, which is where a vast majority of the water and the new, you know, the the resurgent Tulare Lake is they have received some level of federal assistance for, you know, rebuilding bridges and or just whatever infrastructure. But folks in that county are not currently eligible for individual assistance. So that folks in Kern or in Tulare County are eligible for. So that can make things really difficult, especially when, you know, this is an area where folks are out of work, where they're also, like, especially that the Corcoran area in Kings County is really bracing itself for the flooding that they're expecting. I spoke with someone who runs a donation center in the Corcoran area, who said that they're hearing from folks who can that they're trying to clean out their houses to see, anticipating that flooding is going to come and there's not going to be much that they can do. So that's, I think in some of these areas, folks are really on edge because they don't know what type of resources are going to be available to them. And they've been told, and I think accurately, that water is coming.
Nicole, thank you for the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nicole Foy is a California Divide CalMatters reporter based in the southern San Joaquin Valley, providing a firsthand look at how this slow-moving natural disaster of flooding is unfolding in the Tulare Basin following record snowpack in the southern Sierra Nevada. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The atmospheric rivers that pounded California in the first weeks of the year cut a wide swath of destruction and claimed the lives of at least 22 people across the state. In Sacramento alone, the January storms toppled nearly 1,000 trees, crushing homes and cars. A few months later, we're now learning the wave of storms in January alone cost Sacramento millions of dollars, making it one of the most expensive storm stretches for the city in decades. And Sacramento is a snapshot of the economic impact and challenges the rest of the state faces, as some experts warn that these powerful storms will become even more expensive in the years to come. Joining us now to share their reporting on the financial impact of the January storms and the bigger picture is CAP Radio Sacramento government reporter Kristen Lamb and environmental reporter Manola Sakaida. Kristen and Manola, thank you for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Okay, so this is a duo from CAP Radio. What inspired both of you to collaborate on this story? Kristen, I'll start with you.
Yeah, so back during the storms, our managing editor, Nick Miller, suggested I put in a public records request with the city to see how much the city spent in that hectic period. So I filed the request at the end of January and got all the records in mid-March. Those brought up larger questions for me, and I thought it would be great to collaborate with Manola because our coverage areas, city government, and the environment overlap here.
Yeah, and just to add to that, there's so much work we're doing around extreme weather when it comes to preparing and planning. I mean, so many cities across the state are doing climate action plans, but associated with all that work and all that anticipation for what's to come is this huge cost, and I was really curious about what that looks like, you know, at least in this one example.
Yeah, I mean, the first weeks of the year were just devastating. Kristen, how does the city manage atmospheric rivers, and how was that system put to the test at the beginning of this year?
Sacramento is surrounded by levees, so anytime it rains, atmospheric river or not, water doesn't naturally drain out. It's sort of in a bowl. And the city relies on more than 100 storm water lift stations that pump water out to creeks, canals, or the Sacramento and American rivers. When atmospheric river storms hit for days on end in January, crews manage those systems 24/7. It got especially hectic when strong winds caused power outages because they had to hook up generators to keep them running. Here's Philip Meyer, a supervising plant operator, explaining what they do during heavy rain.
Throughout the duration of the storm, we're making sure that we have power there. We're making sure that all of the pumps are running accurately, and then we're watching the levels of water that are in all of our wet wells, because that's an indicator on, are we keeping up with it, or is our system becoming overcome by the amount of water that's coming down? So all of that is monitored, and then you have employees from all different kinds of trades. That's operators, electricians, instrument techs, machinists, generator technicians that are constantly going out to all the sumps and throughout the combined system that is just making sure that everything's working, and they're resetting pump faults, they're fixing equipment at the sites, the pumps possibly, or the valves possibly. So we want to keep water moving, and we want to keep it below ground. So that's our main focus constantly.
Yeah, I've toured some of those stations, and you, some of them are discreetly in neighborhoods. You wouldn't think it. But yeah, there's a lot of them. So you reviewed like hundreds of pages of city documents, and you were able to find an estimated cost of the impact to the city of Sacramento from New Year's Eve to really about mid-January. And the total was nearly $4 million. Were you able to break down what this estimate includes?
Yeah, so it includes public records from the city's Department of Utilities, Public Works, and the 311 division. There are about 350 pages. The estimate covers filling potholes, clearing trees, and repairing sidewalks, plus expenses for overtime, patrolling levees, and using generators. But the nearly $4 million doesn't include storm-related costs for other city departments like police and fire. It also doesn't cover expenses that the city paid after that roughly 20-day period. I ran the number by the city's Director of Emergency Management, Daniel Bowers, and he said while the city is still going through the recovery process, the $4 million is a good estimate.
Yeah, going through all of these documents, was there anything else that surprised you?
I didn't expect to see so many photos. Besides spreadsheet-like documents and summary tables, there were photos attached to public injury and property loss reports, lots of gnarly-looking trees knocking down fences, and there was also at least one picture of a tractor clearing debris from a canal. These damages were caused by both privately owned and city trees.
Even though the beginning of this year was severe, I mean, Sacramento has experienced severe weather and flooding and high wind events in the past. So how did January compare to previous storms that the city has had to overcome?
The emergency management director says January's stormy period was one of the more expensive the city has recorded in the past few decades. But Bowers said the city has experienced windstorms in the past few years that have cost several million dollars. Generally, the city tries to pay for storm damages with insurance first. Then, if there's a state or federal disaster declaration, it tries to get reimbursement. Here's Bowers with some context on damage from a couple of years ago.
We had a windstorm that, for example, knocked down a couple trees into one of our sump stations. That alone, that destruction was $750,000 just for that one item. Now, that was covered primarily by insurance, so it didn't cost a lot of city out-of-pocket expense or anything, and it wasn't eligible for reimbursement because, again, the insurance was covering it. But that was that same year, large mudslides collapsed down on Highway 1 over in Monterey County. So there was some pretty significant regional and statewide damage as well on that. So anytime those types of damages, you know, you accumulate your costs in anticipation of a potential disaster declaration in order to seek reimbursement.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we've been talking with CAP Radio reporters Kristen Lamb and Manola Sakaida about the economic impact of the winter storms on the city of Sacramento. Okay, Manola, as we know, The majority of counties in California were impacted by this series of atmospheric rivers across the state. So Sacramento is really a snapshot of the financial impact. What did you learn when it came to the bigger picture and climate challenges that are facing communities across the state?
Right. So what we know moving forward is that the cost for dealing with atmospheric rivers is going to go up because of climate change. And, you know, to back up a little bit there, a lot of people that are familiar with California's climate are probably familiar with this phrase, but California is often described as the land of extremes. So
the most variable, like, yeah, weather and climate, right?
Exactly.
In North America or something. Yeah.
Exactly. So we're just this really great example of a huge swath of land where you see these huge variable climates, weather extremes, you know, atmospheric rivers, drought periods, you know, many dry years, and then interrupted occasionally by a really wet year like this past winter. So that isn't out of the ordinary. But what researchers told me is out of the ordinary is that atmospheric rivers are going to get more severe with climate change. That means, you know, bigger storms, stronger storms. And that causes more damage for communities because of flooding and damage to buildings, things like that, things that we were, you know, looking at together. And we also saw how the January storms took down, you know, trees all over Sacramento. And just the cost of that alone was so much. And that's just a piece of the damage. So, yeah, the cost of these storms is already high, obviously. But I wanted to learn more. So I talked to Tom Coringham. He's a researcher at UC San Diego who studies the economic impacts of extreme weather. Through his research, he's found a rough estimate of their current cost in California and in the U.S.
For the Western United States, for the 11 Western states, the cost of atmospheric rivers averaged about just over $1 billion a year and accounted for more than 84% of total flood damages in the Western United States. California actually accounts for just over half of the total damages, so over $600 million a year.
And, you know, like you mentioned, California is this huge area of land, and we're all coastline, so it's not surprising that we bear the brunt of those costs. So, yeah, we're really just on the front lines when it comes to receiving the impacts of atmospheric rivers.
Yeah, and we're just talking about flooding and wet weather in terms of extreme weather. And obviously, California goes through other types of costly extreme weather as well. Mm-hmm. Wildfires come to mind. When you spoke with researchers at UC San Diego who are really studying these economic impacts, right, what stood out to you most from the conversations that you were having?
Yeah, Tom, that researcher that I mentioned, wanted to emphasize that the costs aren't super consistent from year to year. You know, like we mentioned, there's these periods of dryness and then occasional wetness. So it's not always easy to say this is the cost per year. So that's why he kind of, you know, averaged it out. But that doesn't mean that these estimates aren't helpful. They can still give us an idea of what's coming and remind us of what we can do to prepare. And even though a key takeaway from our conversation is that these costs are going up no matter what, we still have some control over exactly how much.
We expect costs associated with atmospheric rivers to triple by the end of the century under a high emissions scenario. If we're able to limit greenhouse gas emissions over the coming decades, we may be able to reduce that to just a doubling of damages. So whatever happens, we're expecting an increase in damages.
Okay. And obviously, California has these robust climate initiatives, right? And these goals that the state wants to accomplish. Sacramento as well. I mean, that city is just an example. So how is the city of Sacramento planning to address this likelihood of worsening climate extremes in the future, but also the obstacles that the city faces?
Yeah, a big problem, and this is not just a problem for Sacramento, but for many cities like Sacramento, is that Sacramento was built in an area that naturally floods in a floodplain. So, you know, homes were built in floodplains. And even though cities like Sacramento have levee systems to kind of help manage that, it's not something we can completely control. Cities are trying to respond to that now. And Tom told me that there are definitely some things cities can do to reduce costs.
The study that we did didn't consider changes like increase in exposure or changes in vulnerability. So if we're able to limit new construction in floodplains, or if we're able to increase the resilience of communities, then we may be able to further limit future damages.
So his estimates aren't, you know, this exact prediction of our future. You know, we can still make a change now and really anticipate what's coming. But that does mean that we need to act now. And obviously, that does come with its own costs. I also talked to Jennifer Venema about that. She's the city's climate action lead. The city doesn't have you know, exact costs attached to future storms, but she told me that right now there are projects the city is focusing its efforts on in order to shelter vulnerable residents during winter storms. You know, think warming and cooling centers. But what she told me is that the city really wants to build those out so it can serve a wider group of people.
Projects like that will be more important as we move forward to ensure we have a broad network of how we can activate and provide safe options for our residents.
Right. And that's an important point because, you know, these risks come as Sacramento, along with many other cities, have a record number of people experiencing homelessness. So, Kristen, I mean, this initiative that the city's talking about, it follows unhoused people who died in Sacramento during January storms.
Exactly. The coroner's office said two unhoused people were found dead with trees on top of their tents in early January. The office identified them as Rebecca Rode, age 40, and Steven Sorensen, age 61. They were found in the city of Sacramento, near the river, and in North Highlands. Our colleague Chris Nichols has reported on how some unhoused people say it's difficult to access shelters scattered in the region. And then there are also, you know, trust issues and all of that.
Yeah, there's a lot of barriers. You know, we're hearing a lot that there are these estimates, right, that costs are going to go up. But they're estimates, right? And they can't give a specific number. When you're having conversations with the people for both of your pieces or the piece that you collaborated on, did you learn more about why they can't give a more accurate estimate on how future winter storms will cost? Kristen, I'll start with you.
On the city level, Bowers says it's almost impossible to estimate the cost of future atmospheric river storms or any disaster. I mean, he was giving, you know, wildfires or civil unrest as an example, because a variety of factors influence the severity of storm damage. A windy rainstorm might cause more damage if previous rain left the ground saturated, for example.
Yeah. And like I'd mentioned earlier, the variability of the weather here is a huge part of why it's hard to estimate. And also partially why when I was talking to Jennifer Venema with the city, she mentioned that a lot of their efforts are aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions, which has, you know, the after effect of hopefully reducing the severity of these storms. So there are other ways we can look at this too, not just preparing for that cost, but for the cost of reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, and our water infrastructure was built according to historic data. And now with climate change, you know, that data and those records are getting broken, right?
It's totally different. Yeah, the researcher I talked to specifically said that the plans we made then were for a climate that just doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. Finally, I mean, obviously, this is just you're in the thick of it. You know, we're talking about the future. So how is this going to shape both of your reporting moving forward?
Yeah, I think that it's really important to look at not just how we can plan for this extreme weather in the future, but, you know, how logistically are we going to make that happen? You know, what are the costs of that? California has these huge plans and so many different sectors, you know, when it comes to electrification and climate action plans, all of that. And I think the cost is something that people are really curious about. And I think that makes sense. So I think moving forward, that's definitely something I want to be bringing into my reporting a little bit more, just investigating how we financially plan for that.
On the city level, when it comes to those costs, I learned that the city actually uses special codes to track costs for emergencies. So for future extreme weather, I know I can request records because they keep track of all that so they can make sure they get reimbursed through insurance or through FEMA. And, you know, as journalists, we can also ask for those records. Once it's available, I might request that breakdown just to see how things are paid out, how much the city had to pay out of pocket, how much taxpayers had to pay, and I think that would be interesting.
Yeah, data isn't always sexy and it's very time consuming, but it is important.
Yes.
Kristen and Manola, thank you both so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
That is CAP Radio Sacramento government reporter Kristen Lamb and environmental reporter Manola Sakaida sharing their reporting on the financial costs the city of Sacramento endured from winter storms in January and why future storms may be even more expensive. Still ahead, the Sacramento Kings' remarkable season has come to an end. We'll reflect on the Kings' first playoff appearance in more than 16 years. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. What a run for the Sacramento Kings. After the team got off to a slow start to the season, many were questioning if the team was going to miss the playoffs for yet another season. But then the team roared into the postseason, securing the third seed. Then came a first-round heavyweight fight against our Northern California neighbors and defending champs, the Golden State Warriors. And wow, what a playoff series it really was. A 7-game battle until the very end. And the end came in dramatic form with a 50-point performance by the one and only Steph Curry. For Kings fans, certainly disappointing to close out the playoffs in this way, but really in totality, it was an amazing, long overdue season. Joining us to put a bow on this year is Kings TV color analyst Katie Christensen. Hey, Katie, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing great. Gosh, so much emotion over the last couple of weeks, you know? I mean, safe to say we wanted to have this conversation under different circumstances, but nonetheless, what an exciting and suspenseful couple of weeks. You know, last time you joined us, you know, you mentioned that you've been with the Kings since the playoff drought began, so this was your first postseason for you, like many of us. How fun was this season for you?
Well, oh my gosh, I'm still going to have to process it, really, with it just ending yesterday. But for the drought to end was amazing. But, you know, kind of looking back at the type of year that it was and kind of what came out of it is really what makes it special. You know, Mike Brown, I think, did a really tremendous job with this team and where he got them. It surpassed pretty much everyone's expectations going into the season. You know, you go into the playoffs as the 3 seed in the Western Conference, you know, you won more games than you've won in nearly 2 decades. You've got 2 All-Stars. You've got 2 players that will likely be all NBA players. You have a very young team that now gained a ton of very useful playoff experience against a team that over the last 10 or so years have built a dynasty, and you took them down to Game 7, and it wasn't the performance I think anyone wanted, obviously, but that is something that is going to carry them a lot farther in years to come. And I feel really confident saying that, you know, A, I'm proud of this team and what they did, and B, this is just the beginning.
Yeah. When it comes to the series against the Warriors 2 weeks ago or so, did you think this series would go to 7 games?
You know, I had a feeling. I thought that the Kings were very, very capable. I thought it was a good matchup for them. But you're also going up against the defending champs, and I knew it wasn't going to be easy. And the way that the Kings came out in the first 2 games at Golden One Center, they were amazing. And I think it put a lot of people's doubts about maybe the season being a fluke to rest. And then, you know, obviously you go to Golden State, you have to play on their home floor, and you knew that they were going to battle. Game 6 was fantastic. What they did there, I think, is something that we should all kind of keep in mind, kind of moving forward, because to me, it was hands down the best performance the Kings had this season. And it was when their backs were up against the wall and it was a win or go home situation. And they gave themselves an opportunity to bring it home for Game 7 and advance. So all in all, I mean, like I said, I'm still processing this season, but I'm incredibly proud of what this team did, and like immensely proud of the city, the fans, and how they rallied and got behind them. And I think that it was so special to watch it from that perspective, because I've seen these Kings fans for so long, like you said, since the drought began. I got here in the 2006 season. And so to kind of watch them have that ability to have the joy and share in it and celebrate it was really amazing.
How was it being surrounded by fans that are just relishing in a long overdue postseason?
You know, I expected it. I was not surprised. And when I say it was the loudest arena in the NBA, that the playoffs absolutely proved it. That environment is like nothing I've ever seen. And I traveled to every NBA arena. And I think part of it too is because, you know, this city has always embraced this team because it's kind of the only show in town. You've got the Republic now, but when it comes to, you know, major professional sports franchises, you know, they celebrate this team and they've always gotten behind it. And it's something that they hold really close to their hearts. So I was not surprised to see the reaction and how they rallied.
And I think you have a lot of, you know, new fans as well, people who maybe weren't even that into basketball, who were like watching every single game with the same suspense and investment.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that a lot of people have their eyes on it now, and not even just in Sacramento. I mean, when you look at the fact that the Kings only had two nationally televised basketball games all season long, the playoffs is one thing that really put them on a different map in terms of, you know, the rest of the country and from an international perspective as too. I mean, the NBA is wildly popular all over the world. And just, you know, social media and the people that have watched throughout the season that are not local, that are not Kings fans, but have started watching these games and now, you know, have them on the radar is really amazing. And I would not be surprised if our national TV schedule next year is pretty beefed up.
You know, you bring up such a good point, because I knew someone who went to one of the games and there was like a family that traveled from Australia to specifically watch the playoffs. They were Sacramento Kings fans.
Yeah, I mean, Australia, England, Taiwan, I mean, everywhere. And in the number of people that even just traveled, you know, from within the United States to come and to be at the games it's kind of amazing to me, because, you know, I've played sports my whole life. I've covered it. And it offers a different perspective, right? Like to see how people really kind of can identify and get behind a team. And, you know, they experience all the highs and lows with you. You know, it's like what's in the locker room and what you feel individually as a player or a coach is one thing. But wow, I mean, fans really feel the pain as well. And I know today is a painful day for a lot of people. And I put out on social media, like, you know, feel it, feel the pain. And when it goes away, just remember, like, this team surpassed so many expectations. And this loss, as much as it hurts right now, is really offering them something that they can build on. And the experience alone, going up against someone like the Warriors and Steph Curry and watching what he did in Game 7. And then to remember, oh, Steph's 35, De'Aaron Fox is 25. Like that just shows you potential and what the window is. And if you want to beat the best, you have to go up against them and you have to experience the failures, right? Because you learn more from your failures as an athlete than you do from your victories.
When it comes to those hard learning lessons that they're going to be unpacking, I mean, how much do you think the coaches are going to look at yesterday's game and nitpick what went wrong and build on what went right? Or do they just kind of move on and look ahead to the offseason?
I think it's a little bit of both, right? You've got to look at what you did. And there was a lot of changes throughout the course of this series, because in a 7-game series, playing the same team, especially coaching staffs that are so familiar with one another and with the players. Mike Brown's staff is very familiar with Steph Curry and Draymond and the rest of the core of that group. You're going to look at the things that you wish you could have done better, but it's always like a Monday morning quarterback thing. Like if you had made a different substitution or pulled a different trigger, would it have made a difference? You don't really know. So I think you look at it maybe a little bit, and then the focus immediately turns to next season. And that's the same for the players, because a lot of these players, there were things exposed during the course of this series and this season that they need to work on. And these guys are professionals, and they will take a little time off and they will get right back to work. But, you know, then you got to look at the perspective of the front office. There's a lot of decisions to be made. There's a lot of free agents, Trey Lyles, Terrence Davis, Harrison Barnes being a really right. big one. Like, now you have to go into the summer and free agency and figure out what changes are going to be made. Now, you know, pieces that maybe you need, you know, in the future, for playoff runs, like we just finished. So it's everyone is thinking about what they could have done different, but I think you immediately kind of you sit on it for a moment and then you move on to how you can change it and what improvements you make.
Yeah, the last time we talked, it was leading into this series. And since then, Coach Mike Brown unanimously won Coach of the Year. Just talk about his impact on the team and how he's found a home here in Sacramento.
First of all, yeah, he won Coach of the Year, but he was also the very first ever in the history of the NBA unanimous Coach of the Year winner. I mean, that speaks volumes to the respect and kind of the challenge that he had coming in this season. So many coaches have come through the doors and tried to take over and tried to turn things around. And Mike Brown was the one that was able to do it. And I think one of the most key things that he did, it wasn't about X's and O's. It wasn't about, you know, decisions on rotations or whatever. It really was about getting this team as a whole to invest in their group as a unit. And realized that he had this phrase like all in, right? Everyone had to be all in. And that meant accepting your role as it was, even if it wasn't something that you maybe hoped for or wanted. And you had to accept that. And then you had to believe that as a group, you all had the ability to go further than anybody else. Forget the postseason predictions. I want to say the postseason prediction was like 34 or 35 wins for this team. They almost got to 50. And so a lot of his success really had to come more from the mental side of what a 16 season playoff drought brings with it, which is doubt. And, you know, you get into a rut, you get used to losing, and you kind of lose that hunger and that fight. And he, I think more than anything, that is what he did for this team, was give them a belief and get them to really invest and be all in that belief.
Do you have a top moment from the playoff series?
Game six, without a doubt. But, you know, it's so hard because game two was so incredible as well. But game six, I think for me, because it showed me a lot about this team. It's really hard to go into Chase Center. I think it was mm-hmm. one of the most difficult home court environments this season, in the sense that the Warriors, I don't even think they lost 10 games at home this season. And for them to go in there in that environment with that amount of pressure on them and to perform the way that they did and really put not only the Warriors, but the league on notice that this team has so much potential and they're capable of so much. And it's time for everybody, the league, the media, the national media, to stop disregarding Sacramento and what they have going on and what they're capable of in the future.
Yeah, because they didn't just win on the Warriors' home turf. They won by a good margin, like almost 20 points.
Yeah, yeah. And that is, I can't even put into words how difficult that is to do in a closeout game.
Yeah.
So again, like you, as a team, as players, you have to look back at the things that you did well. You can't look at just the things that went wrong, because you've got to be willing to look at the things that are hard to look at and then look at the things that went well. And that's what you strive to do, is to do that on a more consistent basis.
How do you think the team is doing this morning? I mean, you have a lot of personal lived experience with things like this.
Yeah, you know, I think everyone's different and handles it individually. I can't say how each member of the team and the coaching staff is doing. I can say what I hope they're doing. I hope that they're allowing it to hurt for a little bit, you know, and hopefully maybe that's even gone to a certain extent in terms of being harsh on yourself. But at the same time, you want that hurt to carry into next season and to carry through the off season, because those are the things that motivate you as players, as coaches, to get better, to improve, to analyze, to critique yourself. But I hope at the end of the day, I hope they're incredibly proud of each other and themselves and what they were able to do, because it is not an easy thing, especially in the Western Conference, to get to where they were. It is incredibly difficult to maintain, to stay healthy, to go over an 82 games regular season and go into the postseason and perform the way that they did. So I want it to hurt. I think everyone needs to allow that to happen. And to a certain degree, yes, you let it carry to the next season because that's what you build on. But they should be so immensely proud of what they were able to accomplish and the drought that they ended.
Yeah, I mean, understandably a lot of disappointment, but also a tremendous amount of gratitude for the team as well, for giving us something that we have wanted for so long. Katie, thank you so much for the time.
My pleasure. You guys have a good day.
You are just along with them, too. So hopefully you get a much deserved break as well. Katie Christensen is the TV color analyst for the Sacramento Kings. And that is Insight for today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.